Can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be with you this morning, to be worshiping with you. And see, we've got a lot of visitors with us, and I certainly am glad to see you. You're our honored guest, and I've got some visitors, and just tickled to see everybody. To let the visitors know, in case you're wondering, I am not the regular preacher, as you probably know. Danny is in South America, and I'm just filling in. And I also will say that regardless of what calm composure I may seem to exhibit, I really don't take this very lightly. There's a lot of responsibility to being a preacher or a teacher. I don't ever intend to be a full-time preacher. That's not my aspiration in this life. But my aspiration is to help people, in whatever capacity I'm given the opportunity for. And a fellow over at Charles's one time, and one of his friends was over there, and he referred to him and me as preachers. And I said, "No, wait." I said, "I'm not a preacher." I said, "I'm an opportunity acceptor." And there's a big old difference. And so this morning I have accepted the opportunity to be doing the speaking, and I don't take it lightly because I'm holding the hands of your minds in captivity for a few minutes, and I've got a great responsibility. So if I say something wrong or do something you don't agree with, please let me know, and we will talk about it, and I'll show you where I'm right. Kidding. I may not be right. John chapter 16. We have the build up of to verse 33 where Jesus is preparing his disciples for the time that he's no longer going to be with them. They're going to see some things that are tremendously hard to deal with in the next few weeks as they see his crucifixion. He's been their master, he's been their leader, he's been their teacher for quite some time now. They've grown quite used to him, and he taught them how to walk with him. He taught them that he's holding them by the hand, and how great that is when we have a spiritual leader, a father, a mother, a mentor in some way, and all of a sudden we realize they're going to go away. And not only are they going to go away, they're going to go away in a very cruel and hateful fashion. But he says in verse 33, "These things I have spoken unto you, that in me you might have peace. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." And just like Jesus has overcome the world, we can overcome the world through Jesus. Paul exemplified this attitude in Philippians 4 in his writings when he said, "Those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you. But I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at the last your care of me has flourished again, wherein you also were careful, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. I know now how to be abased, and I know how to abound, and everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, and to abound and to suffer need." And notice this verse, Philippians 4 and verse 13, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." What a tremendous attitude Paul exemplified. And he had this attitude because he was happy, because he was comfortable in the gospel. He was content in whatever situation he was because he had Jesus. Jesus had him by the hand and was leading him through life. We have that same privilege. And we have to realize that since our responsibility, not only our privilege, but our responsibility to be content and to be happy, we have to think about is our influence as Christians linked to our happiness. Sherman and Gary Keith will follow up with this lesson tonight and talk a lot about happiness and talk about our identity as a Christian. But I want to talk about, is that happiness linked to our influence? How many people recognize this person up here on the screen? Have you ever been around a really grumpy person, a really grumpy Christian? I want you to think back in your mind for a little bit here, and go with me back to the time before you were a Christian, the time that you were being influenced to become a Christian, the time, and you were also at that same time being influenced to not become a Christian, to live in the world, to continue living in the world. Even after you became a Christian, you were being influenced to go back over to the other side. Who had an impact on you at that time? Who had influence on you? Yeah, it may have been Danny McKibben. It may have been Austin Mobley. It may have been Cecil Sawyer. It may have been some other great preacher. I remember when we were kids, J.T. Smith preached a meeting here. Had a lot of great impact on me. But you strip that person away, was there anybody left? What's more, you strip all those other people away and put Danny McKibben up here by himself, And that's the only influence you have to become, to do the right thing or the wrong thing. Is that enough? Think about the influence that other people had on you. And there were some positive ones, and there were some negative ones. And each one of us will tell our own story about the people who influenced them and who affected their lives. And then we have to stop and reflect on ourselves. Now, I've come along for several years, and now I'm a Christian, and now I'm the one who gets the influence, and I'm the one who gets to help or hurt people. What am I doing? Am I hurting them, or am I helping them? Am I hurting them with my attitude towards being happy? What of these things in our persona, our characteristics, our attributes, what of those things are helping young people or weak people or people that are out in the world that are believing false doctrine? What in our person is helping those folks, or what is hurting them? Our greatest tool is our influence. There is only one preacher this morning that's going to stand before you. There is only one person that at a time who has the opportunity to do this in a formal fashion. But each one of us in this room has an influence, and you may or may not realize how strong it is. But I can assure you it's very, very strong. There are people in this room that have had great influence on me, not only in throughout my life, but this morning just by being here. I look out across the crowd, and people have lifted me up because they're here. And they're here not to hear me speak. They may not even realize I'm speaking. But they're here because they love God, or they're interested in God, and they realize that God has all the answers in this life. In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus dealt with this influence subject in the Sermon on the Mount in verse 12 there. He says, "Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good work and glorify your Father in heaven." Jesus spends a lot of time, not only there, but all through the Gospels, talking about influence, talking about your influence, and he recognized that that's your most powerful tool, that you can change the world, you can change the people. And folks, in this dark world, it's not hard to shine right now, because our world is getting worse and worse and worse. Immorality prevails. People don't realize that it is wrong to involve themselves in fornication. They don't realize that drinking and alcoholism is wrong in the eyes of God. We may not believe that they don't think that, but when you get out in the world and start talking to folks, they don't understand that God doesn't appreciate that. They don't understand that's wrong. That's so simple for us. But we can be that influence for them, not only by teaching them, but by teaching them through our actions. And so our influence becomes a responsibility. And therefore, our happiness becomes a responsibility as well. I'm responsible for being happy? Well, really, you are. Because if you're not a happy person, then we have to realize that people avoid us. And we're not our influence does no good. We have no opportunity to influence. People avoid us if we aren't likable. And you may or may not realize that. If you're not likable, I don't know anybody here that's not likable, but if you're not likable, or if you have bad attributes, people avoid you. And therefore, we quench our influence when people avoid us. So, this morning we'll talk about some things that we might be able to do to be likable. We'll start with a list here that I don't think that it's... I'm going to take my PowerPoint. The other day I did a sermon at Eubank. Right about the time I got ready to start, I shifted this thing just a little bit. Boom, the PowerPoint went away. And so I don't want it to go away here, and I'll just tell you, this is not the list I'm going to focus on. But giving gifts or money, we can do that, and we can make people like us to a certain extent. But how genuine is that? You know, if we're just motivated just to be likable, just so they like us, that's not exactly the right way to go about it. We need to be likable so they'll like God. Having money or social status or political influence, that's a good way to draw attention to ourselves. You know, and that's a true thing that's in the churches and the religious world today. That, you know, if we could get a doctor or a lawyer or somebody that's really rich to come over here and put some better numbers over here on this board, and then we could do all kinds of things and have church social programs and so forth, then we can maybe draw people in and do more for God. But that's not the plan that he has described for us. That's not what he authorized us to be able to do. We could make ourselves likable by just never confronting any bad behavior. We could just avoid it, or we could tolerate it, and we'd say, well, we're afraid to run them off. But unfortunately, as you could probably guess, all those have to have the big red circle with the cross through it. We don't have those privileges available to us as a church group. That is not our primary goal. Nothing wrong with having giving gifts or money. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with some of these things. But what we need to do is work on our hearts. We need to improve our attitude. We need to concentrate on positive things. We need to change those habits that lead us to being a negative person. We need to be a happy person. We need to improve our social interactions. Because those are the things that cause us to increase our influence. So today, in case you haven't caught on to the way I preach and the way I teach, is that we talk about a principle, and then I have a lot of specific action items. Josh McKibben calls it the so what statement, the so what part of the sermon. There really is no need in learning a biblical principle unless we can apply it to our lives. So we're going to do that today. We're going to talk about five suggestions that I have, actually about five and a half, for increasing our influence. Number one, to increase our influence, we need to stop complaining. Now, this is just as point blank as I know how to do it. And I don't mean, and I want to stop and point out here that the comments that I make from here on out, I developed this lesson for myself, as I do most of my lessons. The lessons come from something that I have thought about, and I have realized that in my life, there are problems. And so I'm going to start trying to work on them. And then as I see change, I'm like, well, that really worked. That helped a whole lot. That helps me to be a happier person. So let's take it out and let other people benefit from the work and the discoveries that I've made for myself. But complaining is not something that I generated in my own mind to stop it. God becomes very, very unhappy when we complain. He doesn't like complaining. I didn't take the time to do it, but I really wish I had time to go through a King James Concordance and just pulled out how many times the word murmuring is used, how many times the idea of complaining, and how many times, it would take a long time, the reason I didn't do it, how many times God recorded that he was unhappy about complaining. But one such time is in Numbers chapter 11. Now think about the Israelites as they left the land of Egypt. They had been in captivity there, they had been in bondage, and they were carrying bricks, big bricks. If you ever saw the pyramids, you realize that they weren't carrying bricks like we use, the little 2 and 3 and 4 pound bricks. They were carrying big bricks, and they were working around hot furnaces, and it's not cool in Egypt. It was a tough job, a tough life. They were slaves. They had no rights. They had no privileges. God let them out. Remember all the things he did? That to let them know that he was God while he was proving to Pharaoh that he was the God. And they endured the 10 plagues. The 10 plagues that was pronounced on the Egyptians on behalf of the Israelites. And then he led them out of the land of Egypt. They were led up to the Red Sea, and they thought they were going to die. There was no possible way of escape. And Moses raised his arms and the sea parted and they walked across. I mean, if you don't believe in God by that time, I don't know what can happen. But now they're in the wilderness, and they're waiting to go over into the land of Canaan, the land of promise. And the wilderness is not a good place. It was not a pleasant place. There's no doubt about that. But the people were complaining anyway. And he had provided food for them. He was providing the comfort that they needed. But it says in Numbers 11 and verse 1, and I like the way New American Standard puts this, so I've used this one. Now the people became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. How many times have you ever been around somebody who became like those who complain of adversity? I mean, that sounds like God has got a whole category of people that he don't like. He likes them, he loves them, but he don't like what they're doing. He don't like their attitude. They became like those who complain of adversity in the hearing of the Lord. And when he heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of the outskirts of town. Think about this. I am so glad that God doesn't deal directly with sin so much as he used to. Because I think that there are several in this group, including myself, that probably would have a lot of scorch marks. Their suit coats would be burnt. Because they're standing close to the ones who are like those who complain of adversity. We have hard times, and it sometimes seems that we can't help complaining. But we can if we work hard. We can if we identify this problem in our lives and put it behind us, because it makes God unhappy. It becomes a habit when we complain. And it really causes all kinds of problems, because it is becomes the way we respond to adversity. It becomes the way that we respond to whenever things don't go our way. And it causes people to bond in an unhealthy way. And I left my notes over there a while ago, but I'm going to let my class help me. I think it's Proverbs 18. It's bad when you come to preach and you just forgot your notes. Proverbs chapter 18, we discovered this verse back here a while ago. And it says, and I'm going to read it from the New American Standard Version. Proverbs 18 and verse 8. The words of a whisper are like dainty morsels. I like this. I think it says nasty trifles in the New King James Version. In verse 7, a fool's mouth is his ruin. But I want you to think about this bond that we develop with other people. It may be at work. It may be out in a social setting. Or it may be at church. And think about when you are new to a community, or you're new to a job, and you come in and maybe months pass and you don't know a particular person very well, and you kind of would like to know them. Maybe you're cornered with them on a trip or in a business meeting or in some setting where you kind of got to talk, and you realize you really don't have much in common. But suddenly, the comment is made about the annoying boss, or there's comment is made about something that's going on at work that you really don't care, that you didn't really like. And you find out through some real subtle language that this other person doesn't like it. Now suddenly you have something in common. You both don't like the boss. Did you see what that crazy boss did the other day? Suddenly you have a bond with this person. Now you have begun to form a relationship. Is that relationship built on something that's very healthy? No, it's not. It's not built on a healthy thing at all. It's built on something that was very negative. And now you're going to add to it. Now, are you going to change it and build it further with more positive things, unhealthy things? Probably are. And next thing you know, you work into this habit. That pays dividends that are not dividends you want to make, because at some point you realize that it's not a healthy relationship. Now, complaining just makes you miserable too. I've been there, and like I say, I wrote this sermon for myself. I realize, and I work for the government, man, I've got a lot to complain about. I mean, these folks, now there's all these people that won't work. There's all these people that there's only two of us there that work, and one of them's me, you know, and that kind of attitude. If you become miserable, and I catch this with the folks that work with me, and they catch me in this, and it becomes a problem. We'll talk about that in just a second. People pull away when we're negative and when we're complaining all the time. And therefore, going back to what we said a while ago, you miss opportunity. And people don't trust you, because they figure that if you are going to complain about somebody else, then you're going to complain about you. I've seen people that won't take a day off from work because they're complaining and unhappy with everybody there. And I really think they are afraid that people are going to talk about with them when they're gone. People don't trust you when you're that way. And I'll tell you a little secret about veterinarians. I don't know about other professions. I suspect it's true with plumbers and with doctors and with all kinds of people, that whenever I pull up to a farm back when I was in practice, and all they're doing is complaining about the person that was there the last time, I'm going to be the next one on the complaining list. They're going to be complaining about me next. That's the way it works. And whenever you become a complaining person, people don't trust you. But here's the biggest point. It is a contagious and powerful negative influence. That's the problem with griping and complaining. It is contagious and it is powerful, and we see example after example after example all through the Old Testament with our Israelite study that we had on Wednesday nights for the last several years. And then we go to the New Testament, and Paul and Jesus and all the different ones who recorded in the New Testament said the same thing. It's a contagious and it's a powerful negative influence. It gets the bullseye. Number two, besides stopping complaining, we need to be positive about our Christian mission. We need to realize and think about Paul's attitude that we read about earlier in Philippians 4, that in all of his adversity, he was content. Out of all the things that were going wrong, in the first 7 of that chapter, he says, "I have found the peace that surpasses all understanding." That's what he was happy about, and that led him to be a happy person overall. I have no idea if Paul was the jovial, joke-telling type of a guy. Probably wasn't, because it wasn't really part of our culture, I don't think. But I think he was happy, and I think in whatever way they expressed happiness in those days, he expressed it because he was happy. And God clearly outlines our strategic plan about our Christian mission. We don't have to turn to all the bad things as far as the unauthorized means of attracting members, that whether it be all the social programs that religious groups get into, whether it becomes that we join up and build a hospital. Those things are not authorized with the Lord's money. But what sometimes folks do is they say, well, we're not allowed to do that. We can't attract members. We can't do anything. So we just quit. There's just no reason for going on with that. There's no need for working so hard. I want you to look real quickly at a little bit of a math puzzle here, a math problem. And I don't like math any more than you do, but sometimes it can make a point. Did this back in the class in the back a few years ago, and Deborah Phillips said, you ought to share that with the whole church, so I'm going to. Here it goes. Notice the destruction that was caused by the 10 spies. Now, there was, a while ago, we were reading in Numbers 11 about the Israelites that are now poised and staged, ready to go over into the land of Canaan. The land of Canaan was great. It was the place they all needed to live. They all wanted to live. But notice that these 10 spies, there were actually 12, Joshua, Caleb, and 10 other spies, one from each tribe, that were commissioned to be their influencers. They were commissioned to go over and look at the land of Canaan and figure not really out whether or not they ought to try to go in, but how to go in. Now let's do this math problem here. And I just pulled this number off from some of the studies we've done before. Estimated maybe at this point about 2 million Israelites. You'll see here in a minute, it doesn't really matter whether it's 1 million or 4 million. I just went with 2 million Israelites. 10 spies kept those 2 million people out of the promised land. Let's throw the math to it. 10 spies divided by 2 million people, 2 million Israelites, equals what percentage of the people had a bad attitude? 0.0005%. I did multiply that by 100 for you math folks. Of those people, 0.0005% of those people had a negative attitude towards God's commission. Remember what happened? Joshua and Caleb went in, and they said, man, that place is something else. It's got grape clusters that two men have to carry on poles. It's got honey and combs that are so big we could never eat all the honey out of there. The land is so fruitful. And yeah, there are some giants there, and there are some warriors there, and they're bigger than us, but we got God on our side, and we're going to prevail. Let's go do it. What did the 10 spies say? They said, oh yeah, there are grape clusters that are really big, and there's honeycombs that are really big, and it is a fruitful land, and it's great, but man, we can't go because those men that are there are giants, and they will kill us all. We cannot prevail over them. The same information was presented, but it was presented in a different way. But these 10 spies had the negative influence over it because people sometimes choose the negative side. Now let's take this 0.0005% and multiply it by 140 members or so in a congregation. What does that come out to be? 0.07% of a Christian. Steve, what is 0.07% of you? Maybe a pinky fingernail? Not much, right? What about your spiritual attitude? What about that percentage of your attitude towards the work of the church? How much damage you can do by just a subtle little bad attitude? How much damage? It can do a lot of damage. It caused 2 million people to not get to go into the land of Canaan, and they wandered in the wilderness then for 40 years because of their lack of faith in what God had asked them to do. When they came up against a seemingly insurmountable job that God asked them to do. Number three, become self-aware. We got to stop and reflect on ourselves as to what attitude we're presenting. Realizing how much negative influence we have, we've got to think about what we're actually portraying in our with our tongue and with our countenance and with our attitude and with our actions and with our presence. Are we doing damage or are we doing good things? We need to reflect on our interactions with people. You know, I see the good things like this singing that we had here recently. And we keep going back to that. But that's such a powerful influencer for people in the community to show them that we're not bad people. We don't have bad praise and worship just because we don't have instrumental music. We can have an opportunity to illustrate how good things can be. And we have. And it has created so much excitement. I had the opportunity to go over and lead the singing for the Eubank singing that they had. And we had 204 people there. Actually, there's a few more I think they missed that I saw that they didn't count. There's probably 210 people there in that little old building. And they were so fired up and excited. And I got the opportunity to go back that next Sunday and preach for them. And they were just on fire. And then I went, Pat Blanton told me the other day she'd gone over there, and they're still referring to that. She heard them all talking about it before church started. How great that was and how excited they were. These things, we don't have to make it a one-time-a-year event to be excited and happy. We don't have to let that do it and say, that's the only thing, that, the only way that now that we can attract people from the community or people who are not Christians. We can do all kinds of things to fire people up. And it all starts with our enthusiasm. It's not about social programs. It's about enthusiasm. It's about excitement. And it's about realizing where we are. Realizing how people look at us. We need to ask for feedback sometimes and actually listen. That hurts, doesn't it? Mary Lee's always happy to share with me feedback. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. We were talking about Josh McKibben earlier. Pat said, you know, he's become such a tremendous preacher and a tremendous man, by the way. And I tell you, I'm pretty close to Josh. And I can tell you one of the reasons for that. If you offer a suggestion to him, it don't fall on deaf ears. You'll see it. He may decide not to incorporate it into his life because it may not fit. But it may be my opinion that it fit. But he will incorporate it. He will give it due consideration. And next thing you know, he becomes stronger for it. I see that in so many people here. I see this in not only the young men who are trying to preach and teach and do things in the service, but in Christians that are teaching in the back and in Christians who are working out in the world. I see the growth that they're incorporating into their lives. And I think that they do consider this. I just want to turn it up a notch. Let's consider what we look like to our family. Let's consider what we look like to the people around us. Let's consider what we look like in the eyes of God. Because we have to know the truth before we can fix our problems. And then finally, we need to analyze what need we're trying to meet by being negative. You know, if you come home in a bad mood, and you snap your kids' heads off, and you tell your spouse off, and you have all kinds of problems, probably it's nothing that they did. Is it fair to do that? There's something underlying. There's some kind of problem that happened at work that caused you to be that way. Or some kind of stress that's in your life that's not appropriate. But it's not appropriate for us to decide to complain or gripe or be unhappy whenever there's something underlying causing it. Let's go figure out what that underlying need is. Is it jealousy? Is it low self-esteem? Or is it just pure hatred? What is causing us to be that way? Or is it just boredom and it's just easier to do that? And that's what happens a lot of times. Let's start being positive. Let's start looking at ways to find that. Number four, and I'm not going to spend much time on this one because this is where we're going tonight in the lesson, in part two. We've already talked about being happy and positive, and we've established that we really, really are. Sherman's going to spend a lot of time on why we need to be happy and positive as Christians. And then Gary Keith is going to talk a lot about that we are a new creation. You know, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, Paul says, well, you are a new creature, a new creation. In Colossians chapter 3, he tells what that looks like. And Gary Keith is going to develop some of those tonight. But, you know, in short, should a Christian, when we're X year number of years old, that we're going to become a Christian, we're really making a decision that is going to change what we are. If you're a physician and somebody flops over in front of you and passes out, well, you're not going to stand there and watch. You're going to jump over and help them because you're a physician. That's what physicians do. If you're a surgical nurse or some of the folks here are, Doris and Linda are always there. If there's some kind of crisis going on, they're there. They're the ones everybody leans to because they can solve the problem. That's what they are. And what does a Christian have to do with all these things that crop up in our lives? We don't have to sit and evaluate whether or not I'm going to go get drunk Friday night. I'm a Christian. I don't have any business doing that. I've talked to people who you know, you drop four-letter words in the middle of a sentence, right and left, and the next thing you're going to do is talk to you about the gospel. Well, what influence are they going to have? So they just use a bunch of bad words. And then number five, we need to be pleasant when we're dealing with others. We need to learn to truly enjoy others' company. Day by day, continuing as one mind in the temple, breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. That's in Acts chapter 2. That's the early church. Right after the day of Pentecost, when they had 3,000 souls who were converted. And this is how they were living. This is the example they left for us. That they loved being together. They loved being around people. And that's what we need to do. We need to learn to be pleasant. We need to learn to truly enjoy others' company. We need to learn to smile. You know, so many times, a smile can speak volumes of positive things. If you're in a bad mood, and you know, sometimes you get around people and you know they're in a bad mood. They've had a hard day, maybe they're sick, but they smile. You say, man alive, I really appreciate that. But the lack of the smile speaks volumes. And you take the Mona Lisa, for instance, that I've got in the background there. Everybody's wondered what she was so happy about. What was she smiling about? Was it a genuine smile? We need to learn to speak that language. The other day, Mary Lynn and the kids were in Louisville, and I had to speak at a conference at 1 o'clock and on Sunday, and we were going to try to get to church over at Douglas Hills, and they had a 9 o'clock service. And so we're scrambling along, trying to get to the church, and we're coming out of the parking garage, and I'd forgotten to get my parking ticket validated. And so I was having to pay $10 to get my car out of there, and I handed the ticket up to this woman in the booth, and she was really having a bad morning. I think she always had a bad morning from the look on her face. And she just looked at me like I had 6 years. I wasn't doing anything wrong, I don't think. I handed her my ticket, and she just kind of gave me that blank, deadpan look. And so then I gave her my credit card, and she scanned it and did all the things, and she handed me this receipt and a pen back. And I mean, she's just not getting any friendlier. I was the only one in line. It wasn't like she was hurried or anything. And so I signed it, and I got my wallet, and I got my receipt, and I got her little clipboard thing, and I handed it over there, trying to put this away, and she goes, "Pen!" Now, I don't know, have any idea what that woman's like, but I don't want to go home with her, I'll tell you that. And I said, "There you go, ma'am, and you have a really nice day, too." And she melted, and she said, well, you too. And she smiled. Boy, did I feel guilty, because I really didn't say that in a really nice, genuine way. I was being as smart-alecky as I knew how to be without using bad language. And she then, but it just melted her. And I'm like, well, that was weird. But we need to learn to be pleasant when we're dealing with each other, and the power of a smile and the power of a calm, nice suggestion. We need to praise people for doing good things. I think that a lot of times people get discouraged in this building, in this congregation, and they just have not had appropriate praise. They need praise. You know, I'm not fishing for praise for me. I get plenty of praise. I'm talking about the people that just show, that are just members here that just do the background work that don't ever get any credit for it. The people that are here, they may be living right up to their very potential. We need to pat them on the back and say, man, I appreciate you being here. You really encouraged me today. This is a good group of people, folks. We need to praise people for doing good things. And when people are having a hard time, we need to have our little antennas out and say, man, they're having a hard time. I don't know. They say they're sick. I don't know how sick they are. They may not be sick as I am. They may be worse. But they feel bad. We need to praise people for doing the good things that they do. That will do a lot of good. And then we need to get in the habit. You want to break this habit of complaining and looking at the glass half empty? Speak well of others when they aren't around. Start trying to figure out ways of saying nice things to them. And when the conversation in a group is turning bad, start focusing on some good things that person did. Because I tell you, we've probably all been the subject of bad conversations before. And it doesn't feel too good, as you know, because you've experienced it. We need to speak well of others and develop a trust with others. Well, with all that said, I want to review very quickly. And we pointed out that as far as action items in this subject, to stop complaining, to be positive about our Christian mission, to become self-aware, to remember your identity as a Christian, be pleasant with others, and last but not least, you can have no influence on anybody for becoming a Christian unless you're a Christian yourself. You cannot do any good for God's work from a positive direction unless you are a Christian, because that puts you in the place where you're able to have good influence over others. So the steps are very clearly outlined. Of course, we understand that we need to hear the Word of God, and we need to believe the Word of God, and we need to confess the Word of God. We need to confess that Jesus is the Son, that He lived and walked on this earth and crucified. He was a perfect man. He always made the right decisions. And we need to believe that. And if you don't believe that, let me have some time with you, because I think I can convince you of that. And I can go at it from a lot of different ways. One is from a spiritual way. One is from a scientific way. That God and Jesus are real, my friends. And we are going to face Him in judgment someday. And we have to do those things. We have to believe. We have to repent of our past life and turn towards God and become a new creature that we've already talked about. And then, of course, Acts chapter 2 and verse 38 and several other verses illustrate that baptism is for remission of sins. That's the purpose of baptism. Acts 2:38, repent and be baptized for the remission of sins. So how do you get your sins remitted? What is remission? It is forgiveness of sins. To have those remitted is through the death, burial, and resurrection that we share with Jesus, and we do that through baptism, burial and baptism. And then, of course, we grow in Christ and help others for the rest of our lives. There are also some times that we start on the right path and we fail, we fall down, and we break something. But we've got to get ourselves healed, and God makes provisions for that. And the book of Acts, we see an example of that in Simon the Sorcerer, where he fell away. He sinned after he became a Christian. And Peter told him to repeat and to ask forgiveness of the wickedness that he had fallen into. If you've done that, please come forward and let us help you get pray with you and for you as we stand and sing the invitation hymn.